Hi, everyone. My name's Ed, and I'm a PhD student at Carnegie Mellon. And today I'm going to talk to you about exploit hardening. So if you're like me, chances are you've gone online and you've downloaded an exploit before, specifically an exploit for control flow hijack. And you've taken that exploit and you've sent it to your target, and you found that it didn't quite work as well as you thought it would. It probably crashed the program you were trying to exploit. And if you're trying to use an exploit or understand how it works, this can be really frustrating. And so that leads us to the question, why do exploits crash? Why don't they work? And there can be two reasons for this. One is that the exploit was very specific. It might have tried to use a specific feature in either the operating system or the exact binary. And as soon as you change that environment even a little bit, the exploit stops working. The second reason, and the one that we're going to focus on in this talk, are that modern operating systems have operating system defenses that are actually designed to make exploiting difficult. So these include defenses like address-based layout randomization, ASLR, and data execution prevention, or DEP. And the interesting thing about these defenses is that they're not extremely strong. They don't, for instance, guarantee that you have integrity of your control flow, but they seem to work well regardless. So the question that we have left to ask is, how good are these defenses really? Or another way of putting it, how difficult is it to bypass them? And that's what we're going to try to measure. And specifically, we're going to do exploit hardening, which is where we take existing exploits and we try to modify them so that they will bypass or work even when defenses are turned on. So the plan for the rest of the talk is I'm going to tell you a little bit about these defenses, ASLR and DEP, and what they were designed to do. And we're going to talk about a very interesting attack on these defenses called return-oriented programming and how these interact with modern systems that implement the defenses. Then I'm going to tell you about our system for doing return-oriented programming automatically, which is called Q. And I'm also going to tell you about the part of Q that can automatically harden exploits. So it can take in an exploit and automatically harden it so it bypasses defenses. And then we'll talk about how often Q can work on real binaries, and we'll talk about some of the limitations. So let's get started and talk about some of the defenses. But before that, let me tell you about a classical exploit and the things that need to go in it. So for the classical exploit, we need a computation. We need to tell the exploit what it's supposed to do once it takes control of the program. And traditionally, this has been done by using shellcode, which is really just executable code that goes right into your exploit. The other thing we need is we need to take control of the program. And traditionally, this has been done by putting a pointer in the exploit that will overwrite some kind of control structure, something like the saved return address on the stack. And we point this to wherever our computation is, for instance, our shellcode. And exploits usually need some kind of padding or other bytes to make the vulnerability work. So once we have this, we have our classical exploit. And we can think about how do defenses actually stop this exploit from working. So data execution prevention is designed to actually stop the shellcode part of the exploit from working. And it does this using a really simple policy. This policy is simply that memory should not be writable and executable at the same time. And if you think about how this would stop the exploit, consider that your user input has to get written to memory at some point. And so it has to be writable. And because of that, it can't be executable at the same time. And this holds for the shellcode as well. So when your exploit jumps to the shellcode and starts executing the non-executable code, the exploit will crash, and the program is protected. So that's the idea. Now, as bad guys, we'd like to really think about what's another way that we could specify the computation of the exploit that will still work even when DEP is turned on. And so it turns out there's a really interesting attack that's called return-oriented programming that was actually introduced by Schacham. And the idea is that rather than injecting new code into the program, you can use existing instructions from the program to encode your computation. And the interesting thing is that it's been shown that you can actually do this for Turing-complete programs. So let me give you an example of how return-oriented programming can work in practice. So specifically, let's try to write to memory, but not use any shellcode while we're doing it. So the first part of return-oriented programming is you need to have gadgets. Gadgets are essentially instruction sequences that you're going to find in the program you're exploiting that do something useful. That's why they're called gadgets. And so you can see the three gadgets that we found at the bottom of the screen. So to make a return-oriented exploit, what we're going to do is we're going to transfer control to the first gadget and start executing there. So the first instruction is a pop EAX. And to reason about what this is going to do, we need to think about what's on the stack. So let's say that the attacker has put these five values onto the stack in preparation for his attack, and let's think about what happens. So as he executes the pop EAX, the top part of the stack is going to be moved into the EAX register, and then we'll execute a return. So a return, when you control the stack, is essentially going to give you a free pass to jump to whatever location you want. So the attacker can use this to jump to the second gadget. Now, if you think about what we just did, we just loaded a value into the register EAX, and we transferred control somewhere else. So these two instructions allow the attacker to put a value into a register and then transfer control somewhere else. And that's what the gadget does. It loads a value. And this next gadget does the same thing for the EBX register. So this is going to allow the attacker to put a value in the EBX register. And now, if we transfer control to the third gadget, we have a memory write. So this is going to write whatever values in EAX to the address specified by EBX. And since the attacker controls both of these values, he decides what gets written to memory and what address. So he can basically do an arbitrary memory write. And of course, after that, there's another return. So he can transfer control again and use even more gadgets to accomplish more of his computation. So this is the idea behind return-oriented programming. Now again, I have some bad news for the attacker. It turns out there's another defense called address-based layout randomization that in some cases can make it more difficult to do return-oriented programming. And here's why. So when ASLR is turned off, our exploit actually uses pointers to the gadgets in memory that it's going to use. But when ASLR is turned on, it actually makes addresses very difficult to predict by shuffling or randomizing the locations of certain things in memory. And so if we turn on ASLR and our gadgets are in a randomized place, we can't actually set a pointer to them because we don't know where they are in memory. And of course, if this happens, our exploit's going to crash when we try to run it. So this is really bad news for the attacker. Randomized code can't be used easily, at least, with return-oriented programming. But there is some good news. So it turns out that modern ASLR implementations, for instance, in the latest versions of Windows and Linux, actually leave some small amounts of code unrandomized in memory. And it turns out that we can use this to our advantage. So let's look at an example. Let's look at the implementation of ASLR in Linux, and I'll tell you what's unrandomized and randomized. So it turns out that the program image, this executable bytes that are specific to each program, is actually unrandomized under Linux. But libc and shared libraries, these tend to be a little bit bigger, are now randomized. And the stack and the heap are both randomized as well. So what does this mean for the attacker trying to do return-oriented programming? Well, in some cases, for instance on Linux, the only unrandomized code that we're going to have access to is in the program image itself. And it's actually very challenging to do return-oriented programming using the program image for two reasons. First, the program image is usually pretty small. And intuitively, if you're trying to find instruction sequences that do something useful, you'd like to have more code to look for because you're more likely to find something that's useful. Second, the program image is by definition specific to each program. So essentially, we're going to have to find gadgets in every single program that we'd like to exploit. And if we're going to do that by hand, that's going to be a whole lot of work. So this is in contrast to some of the prior work on return-oriented programming, in which it was typically assumed that we would have access to large code bases in memory, things like libc. But now in the modern operating systems, these are randomized. So we can't just simply reuse this work. We need to have some new techniques. And so what we did in Q is we developed new automated return-oriented programming techniques that specifically try to find their gadgets in small code bases like the program image. So now I'm going to tell you about how did we actually build this into Q, the automatic return-oriented programming component. So in automatic return-oriented programming, we start off with a source program. And this is the program that we're trying to exploit and we're going to use as the source of our gadgets. And we also have a computation which is what we'd like to do. This might be to spawn a shell or to write to memory. It depends on what your goals are. And what we try to do is we try to find instruction sequences in the source program that are equivalent to the computation that we want to run. So that's the goal. In Q, we implement this using three different stages. So I'll tell you about each one of these. The first one is the gadget discovery phase. So in gadget discovery, the question that we want to know the answer to is, given some instruction sequence, does it do something that might be useful when we're implementing our computation? So for instance, we might pick a random instruction sequence from the program, and it might be this one, SBB, EAX, EAX, negate, EAX, return. And it may not be clear exactly what that does, which is true for two as well, for Q as well. So we need some fast way to figure out what is this code actually doing. And so what we do, because we have to look at every single place in the program, is the first stage we use a randomized test. So what we're going to do is we're going to take our instruction sequence, we're going to assign random values to all of the operands it uses, and then we're just going to run it and we're going to see what happens. So if you look carefully here, it looks like the value that was in the CF, the carry flag, is being moved into the EAX register. And it looks like this might be something that could be useful for us. So it turns out that we have semantic definitions for different kinds of actions that are useful for computations. These are actually called gadget types. So for instance, this semantic definition is for the move gadget type, which just moves between two different registers. So when you have one of these semantic definitions, you can easily check to see if it was compatible with the results of your randomized test. And in this case, it was. So if we were to do this 10 times, and each time we did the randomized test, it was compatible with one of these definitions, then Q's probably found a gadget of a certain type. So Q has support for a number of different gadget types. The one I just showed you was a move reg gadget type. Two of the other very interesting or useful ones are the store mem gadget type, which can be used to take a value and write it to an address in memory. And another useful gadget type is the arithmetic store gadget, which can do an arithmetic computation like addition, and then it can store the result in memory all in one step. So once you finish randomized testing, it basically will tell you that you probably have a gadget of a certain type. It hasn't proved it. But randomized testing is really important because it's very fast. And so you can think of this as a good way of weeding out different kinds of instruction sequences that aren't going to be useful to you at all very quickly. And the important thing is that this enables you to have a more expensive, more accurate second stage where you can then prove that an instruction sequence has a certain behavior. And that second stage for us we call SMT-based gadget discovery. And the idea is that if you really think about what gadget discovery is, you can actually frame it as a type of program verification problem. So that's what we do. So the way this works is we again take our instruction sequence and we take the definition that we think is true. So in this case we suspect, based on randomized testing, that we're going to take the carry flag and move it to EAX. And we basically want to see if we're correct for all inputs. So what we do is we use a technique from program verification that's called the weakest precondition. And I'm not going to go into details on this now, but at a very high level, what this gives you is it gives you a formula with the following properties. If you take this formula and you use an SMT solver, a satisfiability modulo theory solver, and you can verify if this formula is valid, if it's always true, then you've proven that your gadget, that your instruction sequence is actually a gadget of the type you guessed. So you've actually proven that your suspicions are correct. If this comes back and it says that the formula is invalid, then you know you don't have a gadget. So the nice thing about this is that it enables very flexible gadget discovery. So Q can actually find gadgets way better than I can. For instance, it's found that it can use multiplication to move between two registers. It's found that you can use the LEA instruction to add two numbers. And it's found that that strange SBB sequence is actually moving the carry flag to EAX. And you can contrast that with me. When I saw the SBB sequence, I actually had to get out the processor manual to figure out what that was doing. So that's how we can find gadgets in the source program. the next step of return-oriented programming is arrangement. So in arrangement, what we want to do is we want to think about the gadget types we have, move reg, store mem, and those, and we want to think about how can we actually use those to implement a higher level computation. Another way that you can think of this is that what we're really doing is we're creating a compiler where we're taking a high level program and we're compiling it down to an architecture that's defined by the different gadget types we have. If you think about it, those gadget types look a little bit like assembly instructions. So let me give you an example of what arrangements might look like. So let's make an arrangement that tries to write the value dead beef to the address cafe cafe in memory. So we could do this as follows. So the first thing we do is we use a load constant gadget to store the value dead beef in a register. And we do the same thing for the address we want to write to, cafe cafe, because it's also a constant. And then we use both of these gadgets as inputs to a store memory gadget that's just going to write the value to the specified address. And so this is the most simple way that you could imagine using the gadget types to just do a constant write to memory. But in practice, a lot of times we won't be able to find gadgets of certain types. For instance, we often can't find store mem gadgets. So what do we do if we still want to write to memory but we didn't find any gadgets for doing store mems? Well, we have to use alternative rules. So here's an example alternative rule that doesn't use a store mem. What we can do is we can take the value 0 and we can use an arithmetic store gadget to bitwise AND 0 with the memory location we want to write to. And effectively, this is going to write 0 to that location in memory. After that, we can use another arithmetic store gadget, and this time we can use addition. So we can add the value we'd like to write, dead beef, to the location at cafe cafe. And because we just zeroed out that location in the previous step, and now we've added the value we want, we've effectively written dead beef to memory. And so the point of gadget arrangement is that gadget types are often unavailable. You might want a store mem, but you may not find one. And so you really need to be able to synthesize alternative ways of doing the computation on the fly, or you're not going to be able to create a payload. And we found that this is extremely important as you scale down to smaller and smaller code bases. You really need to have a flexible base of rules for doing these computations. Okay, so the final step of return-oriented programming is assignment. And in assignment, we're going to take the gadgets that we've found during discovery, and we're going to try to assign them into the vertices of our arrangements. And the main constraint is that these assignments have to be compatible. So let me give you an example of why an assignment might be incompatible. So say we have the following arrangement, and we try to assign the following gadgets to it. If you actually look at how the data is flowing between the different registers, it looks something like this. Now, if you look at the second gadget in the center of the screen, it's outputting to the register EBX, and then that's being used by the third gadget on the right of the screen. But the third gadget is expecting its input in the ECX register, and the second gadget is outputting it in the EBX register. And obviously, barring some magic that transports the register, that's not going to work. And so this is an incompatible assignment. So in assignment, we basically want to search over all the gadgets that we know about and over the possible orders that we could execute them to find a compatible assignment. And since this can be a difficult search, we developed a dynamic programming algorithm to do this. And once you find an assignment, you're basically done with return-oriented programming. At that point, it's really easy to print out payload bytes that you can take and put it right in your exploit. So you could do this by hand, and you could create an exploit that bypasses ASLR and DEP. Or what we do in Q is we actually have an additional stage where we do automatic exploit hardening. So in exploit hardening, we're going to take as input an old exploit. This is one that does not bypass DEP and ASLR. And we're going to take this payload that we just generated, and we're going to try to combine them and automatically create a hardened exploit that does bypass DEP and ASLR. So how do we do this automatically? Well, what we do is we use a trace-based analysis. So essentially, we take the vulnerable program, and we run it on the old exploit. And what we do is we record what happens, what the program does, and what paths it takes through the program. Until we get to the vulnerability. And when we get to the vulnerability, we stop this recording. So at this point, we have a path through the program that takes us to a vulnerability. And so what we want to do is we want to reason about other inputs that go down the same path through the program. So we do this by using a standard technique, symbolic execution. And what this gives us is it gives us a logical formula that describes all of the inputs that go down the same path. You can think of these as path constraints. So they'll force us to think about only those inputs going down the vulnerable path. But we also need another set of constraints. We also need exploit constraints, because we want to make sure that we use the new return-oriented payload that we just generated. We want to make sure this shows up in our new exploit. So how do we create exploit constraints? Well, it turns out that if you look at the return-oriented payload, and you look at every time that you transfer control inside the return-oriented payload, each one of these control transfers maps naturally to an exploit constraint that you can put in your constraints, and it will guarantee that that transfer of control will actually happen when you run your input. So at the end of this, we end up with exploit constraints and path constraints, and we could use an SMT solver again to solve the constraints. And if we can do that, we get an exploit automatically that bypasses DEP and ASLR. So here's what this looks like if you build a tool to do this. Here we're going to take a trace, and we're going to take our return-oriented payload, and we're going to try to generate a new exploit, a new hardened exploit automatically. So it's solving the formula right now. It solved the formula. Here's what the new exploit looks like. And now we're actually going to try running the exploit on a machine that has ASLR and DEP both enabled. And it worked, so we got a shell. So this is the kind of thing that we can do completely automatically. Okay, let's talk about things that we might want to evaluate Q on. So first, we want to know, can Q actually harden real programs, exploits for real programs? And secondly, we'd like to know a more general question. Namely, how much unrandomized code do we need to have before we can create return-oriented payloads in general? So to answer the first question, we downloaded a number of exploits from exploitdb.com, and we were able to run 9 of those through Q and automatically harden them so that they bypassed DEP and ASLR. And we were able to do this on both Windows 7 and one of the recent versions of Ubuntu Linux. And this is a generally a very fast process. It takes less than 10 minutes to do this. So you can go from a prototype exploit to a fully hardened one in less than 10 minutes. Now to answer the second question, how much code do you need to have before you can create a payload? What we did is we tried to run Q on every single program on in user bin on my computer, and we tried to get it to make payloads to do two things. The first thing we tried was to have it call a function that was already linked by the program we were exploiting. This is going to be the blue line on the next slide. And then we also tried to have it call any function in libc regardless of whether it was linked or not. So this you could use to call system, execv, lots of dangerous functions. And this is the red line on the next slide. So here are the results. And what you see on the y-axis is the probability that we could create a payload plotted by the program size in bytes on the x-axis. And the two interesting points on here are here, which shows that we can call linked functions in 80% of programs that are larger than the command true, which just returns a true value. That's about 20K in size, so that's pretty small. And the other interesting point is that we can call any function in libc in 80% of programs that are at least as large as NSLOOKUP, which just does a DNS query. And that's about 100K in size. So these are pretty small programs we're talking about, and it's very likely that we can create return-oriented payloads for programs of these sizes. Okay, let's talk about some limitations of Q. So the first limitation is that during the exploit hardening process, we're using a trace-based analysis. And what this means is that we're only considering a single path through the program. It might contain many inputs, but it's still a single path. And we found that in some cases, this could actually be restrictive. So it could be that the exploit that uses our return-oriented payload is a valid input to the program, but it could be on a path that we're not considering. And if that's the case, we won't be able to find that exploit automatically. Another limitation of Q is that Q's gadget types don't have any control flow in them. So we're actually not Turing complete. And the reason for this is that we really just wanted to be able to call functions that were useful to attackers. For instance, calling system binsh or mprotect. And this is usually good enough for what we wanted to do. In the future, we'd like to be able to add this so that we can compare more directly over the related work that tries to find Turing complete gadgets in binary code. So lastly, Q only finds unconditional gadgets, meaning that the gadgets have to work no matter what inputs are supplied to the gadget. And it would be interesting if we could support conditional gadgets, because we could potentially try to automate some of the interesting work that's been going on that uses conditional gadgets, such as trying to find return-oriented programming gadgets that don't actually end in return instructions. Okay, so let's wrap it up. So in conclusion, we built Q, which is a system that can automatically harden exploits so that they bypass defenses, namely ASLR and DEP. And the main challenge is that we have to reuse very small amounts of code, and so we have to be very picky about what kind of code we can use. Q is able to automatically harden 9 real exploits that we found in the wild against ASLR and DEP. And as the final takeaway, I'd like to say that unrandomized code is really actually very dangerous. Even if you only have 20K of unrandomized code in your memory, it's actually enough to make DEP and ASLR completely ineffective. So thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Hi, John Krizzle from Illinois. Two questions. First, just to be clear, I think you had a stage where you had, when you were doing gadget discovery and matching the exploit to the gadget, you had to select among multiple gadgets that did different things, such as storing or doing arithmetic and then storing. Mm-hmm. Is that process automated?
It is, yes. So we have automated rules that consider a number of different alternatives for every kind of computation you might want to do.
Okay. My second question is, wouldn't control flow integrity stop these sorts of attacks?
Yes, it would. So the interesting thing about these defenses is that they're not as good as having full control flow integrity. So part of the idea of this work is that we'd like to evaluate how good are they, since we know they're not perfect.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Dave Milsky, Gramatech. I was a little unsure. A lot of times vulnerabilities will place some kind of constraint on the input that you can have. So get S will stop as soon as it hits a new mm-hmm. line character. That comes only when you're validating at the end, or do you incorporate that into your search?
So that's a great question. So this is one of the things you have to be a little bit careful with. So definitely as a verification that we don't generate invalid exploits, the path constraints that we generate will basically ensure that, for instance, in GetS, we don't end up with a null byte in there. But when you're generating the return-oriented payloads, you also have to be careful. You actually have to guess what bytes are allowed by your exploit. So this is something that the user controls. They can say up front that the payload should not have any null bytes, for instance.
Joe Werther from MIT. I was just wondering if you had any statistics on the prevalence of non-ASLR-based images, I guess, between libraries, and especially the initial executable on, say, modern operating systems like Windows 7.
I don't have any widespread statistics. There's a report in our paper from Secunia where they try to look at whatever they deem the 20 most popular software packages out there for Windows. And their conclusion was that most of those still have at least one code module that's not marked as randomized.
Okay.
But I don't have any statistics other than that.
Thank you. Carl Kosher, University of Washington. So without thinking about this too carefully, it seems like you might be able to come up with a subset of gadgets that would be able to tell you where libc is, and then if you can do that, then you can take advantage of all of libc's gadgets. Do you have any intuition about how well this works? And would you need a large subset of gadgets so that it's essentially pointless, or might that be interesting to look at?
No, I think that's an interesting way of doing it. There's actually another paper called Surgically Returning to libc where they use return-oriented programming gadgets to do exactly that. They try to calculate the address of relative offsets inside of libc. So you could imagine doing that to find gadgets instead. I think that's another approach, and hopefully we'll implement that and see how well it works in the future.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.